listening to Syrup Moose Radio, a show from 93.9 FM CICK, located in Smithers, British Columbia. Ankle Monitor by Carob, and before that, Candy by Cami Cahoe. Welcome to the second hour of Syrup Moose Radio. We are going to jump right in here and check out the second part to No Gods, No Masters. First part aired last week. If you are interested, please go back and check that out. Also, I will let you know the song that's going to play at the end of this episode, because there is one more song, and I have a couple of minutes here to fill up. So, what's going to play at the very end is going to be a band called Scalp and a song called Pit. So, check that out. As always, please make sure that you check out smithersradio.com and see everything that's been going on. Thank you so much to the five now radio stations who carry this show. I genuinely can't believe it. My home will always and is always going to be Smithers, but I am so grateful that people think the show is good and want to air it. I still need a Thursday Friday slot, folks, so get me on Give me that domination. Let me dominate the airwaves. Anyway, yeah, I don't know what else to tell you. The world is bad sometimes and exhausting most of the time. But if you made it through a day and you made it into the next day, that's a win. So celebrate the win. And make sure to check out themarsh.ca for all the other stuff I'm doing. August 1st, I have an EP coming out with Homesick Ghosts. It is called Nature is Healing. There is a t-shirt that is associated with it that I think is pretty cool. And the album itself is great. So head over to themarsh.ca. You can find more information about it there. You can pre-order it and help me make music. If you really want to, you could go to ko-fi.com/themarsh and support me monthly on Ko-fi. I would sure appreciate that. Helps me do all my creative projects, and if I made enough money at it, I would do it full time. So maybe one day, who knows. Anyway, I appreciate y'all. Make sure you support your local radio station wherever you're hearing this. They are almost certainly accepting donations. Donate to your station. And yeah, it's good stuff. There's good stuff everywhere. We just got to find it and find each other and hold on to each other, because if we don't, then what was the point of any of it, right? All right, folks, like I say, No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism, Part 2, the final part. Part 3 will be on next week's show. I hope you're enjoying it. Do get the DVD. It's great. Terrace Library has it. It is part of its collection. So watch it. And let's just get right into it, folks. This is it. No Gods, No Masters.
Louise Michel, Voltairine de Cleyre, Emma Goldman, Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, Buenaventura Durruti, Ricardo Flores Magón. The big names of anarchism wrote, spread, and sowed libertarian thought. The great migratory waves, which had already carried it to the United States of America, also took it to the most remote countries of the earth. Be it in Palestine or Egypt, amongst Jewish exiles or Indian communities, within the confines of the African continent as in the East, and as far as the Empire of the Rising Sun, anarchists were everywhere. At the beginning of the 20th century, all seemed to be for the best in the best of all possible libertarian worlds. Anarchism had become a part of the social landscape, to the point that libertarians could be seen flying their black flag on the brand new postcards. And if they were arrested, it was only disguised as nursemaids for the comic purposes of a Pathé Brothers production. The ultimate irony came in 1910, when Armand Falière, the new president of the French Republic, even went in person to Besançon to inaugurate, in a lavish ceremony complete with the Marseillaise and marching Swiss guards, a monumental statue dedicated to the father of anarchism, Pierre-Joseph Proudhon. But in the wings, conditions for workers remained very difficult. And faced with an imminent global crisis, the need for great change was making itself felt more than ever. And this is how, from France to Mexico, and from Spain to the Ukraine, in a time full of sound and fury, anarchists set about trying to destroy the old world once and for all. However, it wasn't with a revolution that the libertarian 20th century began. Neither was it in 1907 in Amsterdam during this international congress, where the cream of world anarchism managed to more or less come to agreement on the necessity of organizing the movement into national federations, capable of setting off a general strike and revolt should war be declared. The libertarian 20th century began spontaneously much earlier on. At a particular time, in a forgotten place, with this new kind of woman and man creating one of the other great currents of the anarchist movement, individualism. Descendants of the Age of Enlightenment and heirs to Romanticism, individualists were the enfants terribles of their time. They read Nietzsche and Stirner, advocated mass conscientious objection, and insisted on immediately leading a full life at odds with the authoritarian principles of society at the time.
I have examined the trajectories of these people one by one, and what they wanted was to be able to work with their hands, but also with their heads, to be whole men. They wanted to lead what they considered to be the good life, which was far from being an easy life, and they wanted to lead it here and now.
This global desire for change, which led individualists to reject work, family, country, the very foundations of bourgeois morality, brought them to propose an alternative lifestyle and new practices of their own invention, which in turn made revolutionaries of them.
It was to include absolutely all aspects of life, sexuality, education, clothing. They advocated nudity. Women abandoned the concept of corsets, hats, and restrictive clothing.
In place of marriage, they advocated open unions or, in some cases, free love.
Multiple relationships were possible. There was no problem in loving several people at once, neither for women nor for men. At least that was the doctrine, but in reality, of course, there was much grinding of teeth and suffering.
Being individualists did not prevent these anarchists from grouping together, and if they couldn't change the world, then they decided to change the universe. In towns, they created libertarian atheniums, and in the country, agricultural colonies. And wherever they went, they developed coherence in their ideas and actions, like here in Palestine, where Jewish anarchists founded Degania, the first kibbutz. But it was particularly in Latin America that truly libertarian cities grew up. There was New Australia in Paraguay, where, amongst others, Mary Gilmore settled. And the Colonia Sicilia, founded in Brazil by Giovanni Rossi and a group of Italian anarchists, of which only one image remains. For 4 years, these libertarians abolished hierarchies, religion, and money, set up councils, loved freely, and sang songs.
Repatria e Dio e l'anarchia forte e gloriosa e vittoriosa trionferà, sì sì trionferà.
But anarchism didn't triumph, and these colonies, truly alternative societies which were meant to be the seeds of a new world, closed one after another. Certain individualists concluded that in order to change society, you had to change the individual, and to change the individual, evil had to be pulled up at the roots. In their opinion, middle-class schooling instilled authoritarian values in children from the outset and consolidated all the mechanisms of power. It needed to be attacked and revolutionized. They became constructive educationists, devising teaching methods which combined ancient paideia with libertarian principles.
The task of the anarchist was to educate. In a way, you could say they needed to create the new man before they could create the new society. Great emphasis was placed upon intellectual, sensorial, and even physical elevation. No aspect of life was ignored.
Experiments into new forms of education sprung up all around the world, such as Sebastian Faure's La Ruche and Paul Robin's Saint-Puis Orphanage. But one of the most comprehensive was the modern school founded in Spain and based on the anti-authoritarian principles of Francisco Ferrer.
Francisco Ferrer was an important anarchist pedagogue who started something called the modern school movement. And the idea was to bring secular, non-religious education to children, but also to adults. Tried to create an equal relationship between the teachers and the students, where the students could choose what they wanted to learn.
It was integral education. That is to say, it had to be both manual and intellectual. The child needed to know how to do just about anything. It was exclusively based on the use of reason, without imposing anything upon the child from outside.
We are not afraid to say it. We want to create men whose intellectual independence will be their supreme force, who will submit before nothing, capable of discerning what is good, and aspiring to live 1,000 lives in the space of just one. Society fears such men, and we must not expect it ever to support education which is capable of producing them.
The fascinating thing when you read about the anarchist view of education, and in my opinion this is something rare amongst educational theorists, is that they are suspicious of themselves. They are so wary about illegitimate authority that their reflections about education contain a deep analysis of the dangers of indoctrination within their own projects. So you can read things along the lines, "Never forget that we're not looking to produce good little anarchists. Let us always be wary of the power which we ourselves have over these children. We are trying to make free men. They may think differently from us later on. That is how we will know that we have indeed made free men."
These secular and libertarian schools, where children can be seen wearing hoods, naturally stirred up fantasies. And their success was as worrying for the clergy as it was for the bourgeoisie. Francisco Ferrer, their founder, despite always having been opposed to any form of violence, had to be arrested as quickly as possible. During the tragic week in Barcelona, an opportunity was found to wrongfully charge him.
He quickly became a target of repression. In 1909, he was accused of having instigated the Barcelona general strike and was condemned to death. International solidarity quickly developed on all the continents, in the United States, in Australia, in all the major cities of Europe. There were demonstrations for a stay of execution. There were petitions. There were even governments who intervened, asking the Spanish government to spare him. But Ferrer was executed. And then a few hours after his execution, crowds started to gather in big cities everywhere, but particularly in Paris. The Parisian rampage was to be the most spectacular of all. On the 13th of October 1909, there was an uprising of extraordinary intensity. Road workers, who were at that time the cornerstone of the proletariat, arrived with pickaxes over their shoulders and tore up the avenues, exposed gas pipes, pierced them, and set them alight. Paris became an inferno.
The assassination of Ferrer at the hands of Spanish justice, which provoked the most violent uprising in Paris since the Commune, had similar repercussions throughout the world. There were the demonstrations in Kotoku in Japan a few months later, and those of Sacco and Vanzetti in the USA, which all sparked immense international solidarity movements. Faced with this state violence against innocent humanists, numerous libertarians took up arms and attacked what society held most dearly. Exponents of theft, which they preferred to call expropriation, individual reclamation, or revolutionary banditry, attempted to set off in Europe a revolution which seemed too long in the making. Anarchists everywhere struck out at property, and burglary suddenly became a revolutionary strategy.
The problem is very simple. If I'm a revolutionary opposed to capitalism, for what mysterious reason would I not attack a bank? Why would I not expropriate a bank to finance the revolution? Method is another question. I'm not talking about killing the little old lady waiting at the teller's window. I'm talking about a radical assault on capitalism in the form of a bank robbery. In the eyes of a revolutionary, there's nothing scandalous about it. As a little aside, even Stalin did it.
Indeed, that's what all revolutionaries do. But it was anarchists who turned these tactics into a system and associated their names with the biggest robberies of the time. There was Buenaventura Durruti, Spain's leading terrorist before becoming the leader of the anarchist revolution in Catalonia, who, along with the Solidarios, plundered parts of Europe and Latin America. There was Severino Di Giovanni, Argentina's public enemy number one, who pulled off the biggest robbery his country had seen to date. In the Ukraine, Nestor Makhno, at the heart of the Union of Poor Workers, expropriated and redistributed the confiscated goods. But in France, it was Marius Jacob, striving at the heart of the band of night workers, who made the greatest impression.
He was very well organized and very gifted in this domain. Marius Jacob robbed businesses, churches of course, rich individuals, but as far as possible without employing the least violence, and even with a certain elegance. He would sometimes leave little ironic notes for the people he'd robbed.
à destination de ceux qui l'a cambriolé.
Yes, I have stolen a pocket handkerchief from you worth 250 francs. Is a 250 franc handkerchief not an insult to misery?
Marius Jacob, the anarchist thief, who despite committing more than 500 robberies only kept for himself enough to live on, served as Maurice Leblanc's model in the creation of the character Arsène Lupin. But the state, wanting to send a message to anarchists tempted by illegality, arrested him, and despite his eloquence, inflicted an exemplary punishment. This man, who had never shed blood, was condemned to the bloodless guillotine of a lifetime's hard labor and deported to French Guiana. For revolutionary bandits, the message was clear. Since authority sends even the innocents to their deaths, better to kill before being killed. It was in London in 1911 that the first major confrontation between revolutionary bandits and the forces of law and order would be played out. Over several hours during what the history of anarchy would remember as the Battle of Stepney, a siege took place at 100 Sydney Street. At dawn, the neighborhood was completely closed off. Two anarchists holed up in a small house offered fierce resistance to more than 800 police officers and members of the Scots Guards. The operations were overseen by the Home Secretary, a certain Winston Churchill, who could be seen on the left in a top hat. Unable to dislodge them, the artillery was sent for. The house caught fire, and the two revolutionaries died in the flames. Newsreel cameras were sent to the scene where a considerable crowd had gathered to watch the show. But was this young mechanic, who legend has it was Conan Doyle's London chauffeur, among the curious bystanders? One thing is sure. On his return to France the following year, he decided to move into action by forming a gang which would soon send a shockwave across Europe, the Bonneau Gang.
I prefer to call them the Tragic Bandits. Firstly, because this wasn't a gang under the authority of a leader. And if there was a leader, I see no reason why it would have been Bonneau rather than someone else. They were militant anarchists, devoutly militant individualists with a combative past. The young Octave Garnier, for example, had been imprisoned following a construction workers' strike, during which he was severely beaten by the police, and ended up finding what he had been looking for in individualism.
Austere doctrinaires leading exemplary lives, these men were strangers to tobacco, alcohol, gambling, or brothels. They frequented the anarchy newspaper directed by Victor Serge. But it was through their knowledge of mechanics that they first entered history by being the first to use a car to commit robberies. The meager takings were far from being sufficient to finance a revolution, but their attacks were characterized by indiscriminate violence. The number of dead they left behind soared. A price was put on their heads, with the press offering a reward of 100,000 francs to whoever enabled their capture. The brand new Tiger Brigades were set on their trail. But far from being afraid, the bandits defied society, with Octave Garnier going as far as writing to the heads of the 3rd Brigade, known as the Anarchist Brigade.
I know this will come to an end. In the ongoing struggle between society's impressive arsenal and myself, I know that I will be beaten. I will be the weaker. But I hope to make you pay a high price for your victory.
It ended up in a siege between isolated men and a 1,000-strong troop, with 10,000 spectators who had come to see the capture of these hunted men. They fought like lions to the very end, knowing full well that they had no chance of escape. I would say that's what actually turned them into propagandists by the deed.
The Tragic Bandits' actions came to an end on the 28th of April, 1912, in the suburbs of Paris. Here, too, the newsreel cameras were invited to the show. The police placed bombs, which were set off. When the operation was over, the bodies of the anarchists were put on display like hunting trophies. This affair left a lasting impression and momentarily marked the end of revolutionary banditry in France. Bonneau, like many illegalists, gradually became a controversial figure, rejected by or reintegrated into anarchist thinking in accordance with the needs of the time.
Rather than consider the actions of the Bono gang as a genuine protest movement, personally, I tend more towards the theory that it was the manifestation of a failure. That is to say, these are events which sometimes attract a sort of morbid curiosity, but in reality they remain marginal occurrences. And as far as the Bono gang was concerned, it was the marginality of a group which was marginal.
The media circus which had grown up around the Bono gang was above all instrumental in disqualifying the anarchist movement in its efforts to avoid war. Because in the face of mass demonstrations by libertarians, alongside other socialists, here, for example, at the Place Saint-Gervais near Paris, or during the Red Week in Ancona in Italy, where Malatesta managed to spread the general strike to the marches, to Romagna, and as far as Tuscany, the imperialisms were above all worried that the workers of the world might come to an agreement. They had reinstigated the villainous laws and made up lists, like the infamous B file in France, which contained the names of all suspected revolutionary leaders to be arrested should a conflict begin. But thanks to the fear generated by the tragic bandit affair, and faced with the shock provoked by the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo, the state had no need to resort to these methods. And with the death of Jean Jaurès, even some anarchist mainstays like Kropotkin ended up rallying behind the Sacred Union. And while Europe was on the point of engaging in a war which would kill millions of workers, although it's not always remembered, anarchists in Mexico were behind the first great libertarian revolution.
It's hard to understand why the Mexican Revolution doesn't have the same importance attached to it as the Russian Revolution or the Chinese Revolution. But it was the first major revolution of the 20th century.
The Mexican Revolution begins at the end of 1910. And in its early stages, 1910, 1911, 1912, one of the factions, the major factions fighting within the Mexican Revolution was the Partido Liberal Mexicano, the PLM, which is led by the Magón brothers, Enrique and Ricardo Flores Magón, who are Mexican anarchists in exile in the United States when the revolution breaks out.
Flores Magón and his comrades played a fundamental role. As the precursors of this revolutionary movement, they created the conditions necessary for the revolution. You could say that they were a constant inspiration for all the other revolutionary factions. Their propaganda continuously pushed the other factions to be more radical. Magón, in fact, regarded the Mexican Revolution as the first act in the great worldwide conflagration which was just around the corner. For him, the global libertarian revolution was just about to take off.
The Mexican Liberal Party, which was at the origin of the revolution, was liberal and a party in nothing but name. But it was well and truly an anarchist organization, as could be seen from its manifesto, written by Ricardo Flores Magón. Its place in the purest libertarian tradition was not only because it advocated direct action, but also, and above all, by virtue of its call for vast agrarian reform. For it has to be remembered that since its beginnings, the anarchist movement was the only form of socialism to assign a central role in the revolutionary process to farm workers. Furthermore, this explains its success in a Mexico which was still highly agricultural. And this concept spread. It inspired the three other mass revolutionary organizations: Emiliano Zapata's insurrectionary army in the south, the House of the World Worker in the capital in the center, and the Mexican branch of the IWW, which had opened in the north. And the slogan which Flores Magón and the anarchists of the PLM placed at the bottom of their writings was taken up by these movements and became the rallying cry of the entire revolution: land and liberty.
They said to the peasants, grab a Winchester in hand and take the land because it belongs to you. You don't have to wait for the working class to develop. The peasants could have their own revolution.
Magón had confidence in the spontaneity